Rebecca sat at the caliph's feet each day, recording the proceedings in the audience hall. Every evening she was sent back to the zenana in the governor's palace. At first his indifference was a relief to her, but after 3 days it irked her. Had she given him offence by falling asleep in his presence, or bored and annoyed him with garrulousness, she wondered? Or am I just unattractive to him? It really does not matter what he feels. Only what happens to Amber and Nazira, and of course to me also. Endlessly she and Nazira discussed this predicament, which involved them all so intricately and intimately. Their well-being and even their lives were in the caliph's hands. From hating the thought of allowing Osman Atalan to touch her, Rebecca began to fear that he would not do so. Nazira held up to her the example of his fourth wife, Zamata. She was unable to hold his interest, and so even though she is a relative of the Caliphat Abdullahi, he sent her back to Omdurman as soon as she had a babe in her belly. She may never see him again and will probably pass the entire remainder of her life locked in the zenana. Beware, Al-Yamal. If he rejects you, you may not be so fortunate as Zamata. He might sell you, or give you to some old emir or sheikh who smells like a goat. And Amber, what will he do with her? The Caliphat likes children, young children. He would welcome her into his own harem if Osman Atalan offered her to him. You must strive to please him. I shall teach you how, for I have some small experience in these matters. With these threats as an incentive, Rebecca determined to pay full attention to Nazira's advice and instruction. The following afternoon, Nazira returned from a visit to the souk and displayed her purchase, the tusk from the lower jaw of a hippopotamus. "We shall use this as a tool of instruction," she informed Rebecca. "There is much demand for toys such as this among the women of the harem and zenana, who do not see their husbands from one feast of Ramadan to the next. They call them the jinn of the Angareb. The Caliph Atalan has different tastes from those of the Divine Mahdi. Your mouth and sweet lips alone will not suffice. He will require more of you than the Mahdi ever did." She held up the tusk. "The Caliph will be this shape, but if he is so large, you will be blessed indeed." Nazira went on to demonstrate her artistry. Rebecca would never have dreamt that some of the behaviour Nazira described between man and woman was possible, and she found herself becoming more interested in the subject than the cold contemplation of survival required. She thought about it a great deal at night before she slept, and if Amber had not been lying beside her on the same Angareb, she might have indulged in some preliminary experimentation with the ivory toy. However, it seemed that Osman Atalan had lost interest in her even before he had pursued their relationship to its full potential. Eventually, he finished questioning the last of the witnesses. He was about to leave the audience hall without having acknowledged her when, unexpectedly, he turned to one of his viziers. "This evening the concubine Al-Yamal will serve my evening meal. See to it." Although she kept her eyes downcast, Rebecca felt a lift of intense relief, tempered by a stirring of trepidation. "I must play the game that Nazira has taught me to arouse his carnal passions and make our lives secure," she thought, then tried to suppress the flutter of excitement in the pit of her stomach. It seemed, however, that this particular evening the caliph's passions were more conversational than concupiscent. He gave her little opportunity to try out her freshly acquired knowledge. "I know that in your country the ruler is a woman," he said, before he had finished eating.
"Yes, Victoria is our queen."
"Does she rule firmly? And are her laws strong?"
"She does not make the laws. The laws are made by Parliament."
"Ah," said the caliph knowingly. "So Parliament is her husband, and he makes the laws. That is clever of him. He must be cunning and wise. I knew that a man must be behind it all. I should like to write a letter to Lord Parliament."
"Parliament is not a single man. It is an assembly of the people."
"The common people make the laws? Do you mean the cooks and grooms, the carpenters and masons, the beggars, fellaheen and gravediggers? Anyone of this riffraff can make a law? Surely this is not possible." Rebecca struggled for half of the rest of the night to explain an electoral system of government and the democratic process. When finally she succeeded, Osman was appalled.
How can warriors like those Englishmen I have fought allow this obscenity to exist? He was silent for a while as he paced the floor. Then he stopped in front of her, and his tone was diffident, as though he feared her answer. Women also have this thing you call a vote? Women do not have a voice. No women may cast a vote, she replied. Osman placed his fists on his hips and laughed triumphantly. Ha! Now at least I can still respect my enemies. At least your men keep control of their wives, but tell me, please. You say your ruler is a woman. Does she not have a voice? A vote?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Ha! You Franks! He clutched his head theatrically. Are you mad? Or is it me alone? Rebecca found that she was beginning to enjoy herself. Like a pack of hunting dogs, their discussion ranged over wide territory and started some extraordinary game. This was like the unrestricted and open-ended discussions in which her father had indulged her. Beyond the open windows, the cocks crowed at dawn while she was still trying to explain to him that the Atlantic Ocean was wider than the Nile, or even, in God's name, Lake Tana. When he sent her back to the harem unmolested, her relief was tempered by a strange feeling of inadequacy. Before she joined Amber on the mattress, she held up the oily lamp and studied herself in the small mirror. Most men find me appealing, she reminded herself, and thought of Ryder Courtney and Penrod Ballantyne. So why does this savage treat me like another man? She wondered. The next morning she watched with Amber and the rest of the women from the terrace of the harem as Osman Atalan rode out at the head of a band of his Agajirs on a hawking expedition along the eastern border.
Look, cried Amber, there's Captain Ballantyne. They say that the Caliph gave him that horse. On him the jibba looks as dashing as a cavalry dolman. He's so handsome, would you not agree, Becky?
Rebecca had barely noticed Penrod, but she made a noncommittal sound while she followed with her eyes the elegant, exotic figure at the head of the cavalcade of horsemen. He is a fierce and dangerous man, and he's as fierce and dangerous as the falcon on his wrist, she thought. Osman Atalan was gone from the city for almost 10 days. When he returned, he sent for Rebecca. He stood behind her shoulder as he directed her to draw a detailed map of the ground he had covered in his foray across the Abyssinian border. When she had completed it to his satisfaction, he dismissed her. Then he called her back from the door. You will attend me after evening prayers. I want to discuss with you certain matters that interest me. When she found Nazira in the harem, she whispered the news to her.
He wants me to go to him again this evening, Nazira. What shall I do?
Nazira saw the colour in her cheeks. I am sure you will think of something, she said. Now I will prepare your bath. She poured a liberal measure of attar of roses and sandalwood essence into the pitchers of the hot water, then rummaged through the chests to choose a robe fitting to the occasion from the wardrobe that the Mahdi had provided for Rebecca.
You can see through it, Amber protested when Rebecca put it on. With the lamp behind you, it makes you seem naked.
She placed a powerful pejorative emphasis on the last word.
You will look like a belly dancer. I shall wear my woolen shawl over it and keep myself covered throughout the dinner, Rebecca reassured her.
As soon as they were alone in his quarters, the Caliph picked up the subject of their conversation of 10 days previously, as though it had not been interrupted. So, this large water you call the ocean is alive. It moves backwards and forwards and leaps up and down. Is that not what you told me?
Indeed, mighty Atalan, at times it is like a ravening beast with the strength of 1,000 elephants. It can overwhelm ships 50 times larger than any that voyage on the Nile, as though they were dried leaves.
He looked into her eyes to discover if there was any truth at all in these improbable statements. All he found were points of light, like those in the depths of a sapphire. This diverted his train of thought, and he took her chin and lifted it to gaze deeply into her eyes. His hands were strong, and his fingers hard as bone from sword play and from handling his hawks and horses. He made her feel helpless and vulnerable.
I must remember everything Nazira has taught me. She felt her loins melt lubriciously.
This might be the only opportunity he will ever give me.
I shall send an expedition of 1,000 of my most intrepid men to find this wild water and bring it back in large skins, Osman announced. I will pour it into the Nile to overwhelm the British steamers when next they sail upriver to attack us.
She was touched by his naivety.
Sometimes it was like talking to a small child. Not for the first time, she felt an extraordinary tenderness towards him, which she had forcibly to suppress. This is no child. This is a shrewd, ruthless, arrogant tyrant. I am completely at his mercy. Why did that thought excite her, she wondered. But before she could decide the answer, he made another disconcerting change of subject. But I have heard that their steamers are able to voyage on the land further and faster than the bravest horse. Is this true?
It is true, mighty Caliph. These carriages are different from the river steamers and are called steam locomotives.
It took her a few moments to rally her thoughts, and she described how she had journeyed from London to Portsmouth in a single day, including a stop for refreshment. That is a distance greater than from Metemma to Khartoum. Her voice was husky and disturbed. He still held her chin, but now he stroked her cheek and touched a lock of her hair. She was surprised at the gentleness of his hard fingers, this savage warrior from the primal deserts.
"What unguent do you use to keep your skin and hair so soft?" he asked.
"That is how I was born.
It grows dark.
Light the lamps so that I may see you more clearly." She remembered how Amber had disapproved of the transparency of the silk she wore. She slipped the light woolen shawl off her shoulder as she stood up and tossed it over the table as she went to take a taper from the firepot. She cupped the flame in her hands and carried it across to the lamp. It caught, then burned brightly. The warm yellow light chased the shadows along the walls. She lingered there a little longer, trimming the wick until the flame was burning evenly. Her back was turned to him, but she was aware of the picture she made.
"I am acting like a harlot," she thought.
Then seemed to hear her father's voice.
"It's an honourable profession. The oldest in the world."
She smiled in confusion as the ghost voice went on, delivering his often repeated advice to her.
"Whatever you do, do it to the very best of your ability." It was a blessing.
"I shall try, Daddy," she replied inwardly. And at that she felt a touch. She had not heard Osman Atalan cross the room behind her. His hands on her shoulders were strong and steady. She smelt him. It was a good smell, like a well-groomed horse or a cat. Muslim men of his rank bathed as many times in a day as an Englishman did in a month. She stood submissively as his hands ran down from her shoulders, under her armpits, then reached in front of her to take her breasts. They filled each of his hands. He took her nipples and rolled them between his fingers, then pinched them until she gasped. The pressure was skillfully applied, just sufficient to startle and arouse her without inflicting pain. Then he pulled her back against him. It was some moments before she realized that he had shed his jibba and was now naked. Through the silk of her robe she could feel the hard, muscular length of his body pressing against her back. Tentatively, she pushed back with her buttocks and found conclusive proof that he did not find her repellent. With Nazira's advice and instruction still sharp in her mind, Rebecca stood without moving as she appraised that which the Caliph was pressing against her. It seemed to be of similar shape to Nazira's hippo tusk, and it was certainly every bit as hard. She turned slowly in his arms and looked down. "It seems that I am to be blessed indeed," she thought. Like the ivory tusk, he was smooth and slightly curved. She touched him, then encompassed him with her hand. Her fingers were barely able to meet around his girth. She made the movements of her hand that Nazira had demonstrated and felt him throb and leap in her grip.
"Great Caliph, in your manly attributes, you are peerless and imperial." He took the word imperial as a comparison to the light of the world, Muhammad al-Mahdi, who now sat at the right hand of Allah, and he was very pleased. "I am your stallion," he said. "And I am your filly, in awe of your strength and majesty. Treat me gently, I beg you, sweet lord." She continued to hold him. She expected him to pounce upon her, as Rider Courtney had done. But his restraint surprised, then titillated her. She kept her grip on him as he undressed her, and was still holding him as she fell back on his mattress. She attempted to direct him to her source, using both hands, and coming up on her elbows so that she could watch him disappear inside her. But he resisted her urging, and began to examine her as though she were indeed a thoroughbred filly, turning her this way and that, lifting each limb in turn, admiring and caressing them. It was at first flattering to be at the centre of his attention, but he was so unhurried and deliberate that she became impatient. She longed for the delicious sensation of being deeply invaded that she had last known with Ryder Courtney. Still he lingered over her, taking his time so deliberately that she felt she must scream in her desperation. She had once owned a tabby cat named Butter. In her season, Butter would yowl and sob to attract feline admirers. Rebecca understood that imperative now. How many thousand women has he known, she wondered. For him there is no urgency. He cares not at all that he is causing me such distress. She tugged at him again with both hands. I beg of you, great Atalan. Lack of you is torture beyond my ability to endure. Please be merciful and end it now. You asked me to treat you gently, he reminded her with a smile. I am a silly creature who does not know her own mind or nature. Forget what I have said, my lord. You know much better than I ever will what must be done. Make haste, I entreat you. I can wait no longer. He did as she asked, and this time she could not forbear from screaming louder and longer than Butter ever had. None of Osman Atalan's other women had ever acknowledged his mastery in such a comprehensive vocal fashion. He was flattered and amused. He did not dismiss her on rising, as was his habit, but kept her beside him as he ate his breakfast. Soon, none of the other concubines he had brought with him from Omdurman were honoured by a summons to his private quarters. Rebecca took up almost permanent abode in them. She did not bore him, as the others were wont to do.